Conclusion. The realization of metta. Not falling into wrong views, being virtuous and endowed with insight, by discarding attachment to sense desires, never again is he reborn. A finger pointing to the moon. The opening verses of the sutta laid down the necessary foundations of the practice. Now the closing verse describes the results of one's perfecting it. The term dasanena, translated here as insight, is more literally sight or vision, as in seeing the true nature of things. Both dasana and the first word of this verse, dithin, come from the same root. Dithi, dristi in Sanskrit, which means view, commonly occurring in the expressions micha dithi, wrong view, and samadithi, right view. Whereas dasana, like vision, the English equivalent, always has positive connotations, dithi, views, can be positive or negative depending on how it is qualified. However, the word dithi on its own, without a qualifier, is always negative. It is understandable, therefore, that this phrase has been translated as falling into wrong views. But this does not change the meaning. The implication of the Pali word is not only that one should avoid falling into wrong views, but that any view at all ultimately gets in the way of true insight. Even right views are to be given up eventually, in the sense that, although still holding them, one is not attached to them. By view is meant any conceptual formulation to which you adhere as if it had absolute value as a truth statement. I exist is a view, and so is the moon is in the sky. Such views are necessary for communication, and conventionally speaking, we need to label some as true and some as false. From the point of view of the Dharma, too, we need to distinguish between views that are helpful to the attainment of our goal and those that point us in the wrong direction, spiritually speaking. From the point of view of the goal, reality itself, all views are inadequate. No view is capable of expressing that reality. They are expedient means, only representations of things, not the truth. Thus, on many occasions, not only in the Pali scriptures but also in the Mahayana sutras, the Buddha states that the Tathagata, another term for Buddha, is free from all views. Even though he spent some 40 years treading the roads of ancient India, giving discourses, making careful distinctions between right views and wrong views, in reality, as a Buddha, he has no views. This paradox reminds us that we need to hold our views lightly. As the Zen tradition puts it, they are a finger pointed to the moon, not the moon itself. The Buddha uses words like self, person, and enlightenment, for example, but he doesn't have a view of self, or person, or enlightenment. That is, he doesn't adhere to any conceptual formulation of any kind as having absolute validity. Not falling into views means not absolutizing any conceptual construction. However useful a set of concepts might be for the purposes of communication, if you adhere to them as anything more than useful markers, you have fallen into a kind of literalism, or even fundamentalism. Any concept relies for its meaning on its relationship with a whole string of other ideas and concepts which are equally relative. No view, no concept, is independent and therefore fixed. In fact, as soon as you start to take your conceptual constructions too literally and hold on to them too tightly, they cease to function effectively as a means of communication. We tend to think of a concept as the content of our communication. It is easily forgotten that it is more fundamentally a means of communication. A concept is the means of communicating something that is essentially incommunicable. Concepts do not exist on their own. They come as part of a package that includes the way they were presented. To communicate, they must be offered in the right spirit, at the right time, in the right place, and in the right way. Above all, they have to be put across with the right feeling. An idea of meta that lacks the corresponding emotion only muddies the waters when we try to communicate it to others. Indeed, this is true of any Buddhist doctrine. If you want, for example, to communicate the teaching of anatta, that there is no unchanging self or soul, you have to be aware that to insist on the idea of no self and argue belligerently, not to say self-assertively, with those who hold a different view, undermines the very point you are trying to make. In the name of a view that is meant to pull down the barriers between yourself and others, you are, through your self-assertion, building up those barriers more strongly than ever. As a Buddhist, you need to be familiar with the concept of anatta, but you should not cling to any particular formulation of that concept. It is there to be used simply as a vehicle of thought and communication. We need Buddhism as a system of doctrines and practices to be used appropriately, not so that we may have something to hide behind. If you use Buddhism as a collection of ideas to mark you out as a spiritual and perhaps rather interesting or mysterious person, this is at the expense of a deeper emotional engagement with the truth towards which any conceptual formulation can only point. A view of Buddhism, in other words, is an essentially alienated version of Buddhism, and a very different thing from Buddhism itself. Metta and insight. At the back of all negative emotion is the thought, what's in it for me? The final words of the sutta, never again to be reborn, suggest that the goal of metta is a depth of transcendental realization that frees the practitioner from the suffering of repeated rebirth. But how might this be the case? Simply put, in developing metta, we are deepening our emotional involvement with the truth of anatta, or no self. The unenlightened person takes the self, specifically their own self, as the fundamental and absolute reality of things. And this has a profoundly negative effect on every aspect of experience. At the back of all negative emotion is the thought, what's in this for me? Even in our cultivation of positive emotion, the sense of self acts as a kind of gravitational pull that prevents our reaching the heights to which our metta would otherwise take us, and makes it very difficult for our friendliness and kindness towards others to be truly selfless. Cultivating metta is like launching a satellite. It may look as if it's tracing a straight line away from the Earth into space, but in fact it remains tied to the Earth's gravitational field. Rather than disappearing off into the blue, it comes to maintain a steady orbit around the Earth and never fully breaks away. Metta behaves similarly. It is inherently expansive, but however strong our feelings of warmth and friendliness, the very fact that we still think of ourselves as separate from others will have a limiting effect on our experience of it. At some point, those good intentions reaching out across the universe will start to deviate from their perfectly straight trajectory and slowly curve round so as not to lose contact with the self entirely. how far your ability to experience genuine metta carries you before you settle back into a comfortable orbit around the self is a measure of the quality of your practice. The affection between ordinary friends might produce quite a low orbit, while the intimacy and trust of a spiritual friendship would trace out a wider trajectory. The more powerful positive emotion experienced in the deep meditative states called dhyana would take your cause a good deal further out still. Dhyana is clearly a vast improvement on everyday self-interest. It is a far wider, more elevated reach of consciousness. But however wide its circle of influence may be, it continues to be self-referential, albeit more and more subtly. Only when metta is permeated by insight, or perhaps a deeper understanding of the truth of anatta, do your emotions finally go beyond the range of the self. This, of course, is an analogy. When we practice metta, it isn't there are literally beams of metta radiating out from us as we sit and meditate, even though the image might be a useful one. Moreover, that central point of reference, that core of the self, is in reality only a fiction. It is more useful to regard metta as an outward movement of the self rather than from the self. As we continually expand the scope of our care and concern, the self is universalized, one might say, or expanded indefinitely. This does not mean that we have to transform our sense of who we are according to an idea of how we should be that is quite alien to how we experience ourselves. It is rather that our direct experience of ourselves should be that we are continually going out to be aware of and concerned for the well-being of others, not fixed on any single point of identity. The directly experienced insight into the truth of no self, anatta, is the first real breakthrough on the journey towards enlightenment. It is traditionally known as sotapatti, entering the stream. The stream entrant is one who has broken the fetter of self-view, who understands directly and intuitively that the separate self, the I, is no more than an idea. An idea that is the ultimate source of our unhappiness and lack of fulfillment. This insight is not merely cognitive, not a matter of intellectual assent to a logical proposition. The stream entrant lives his or her knowledge, experiencing it in the form of a fully developed positivity. Once one has reached this point, one will never fall back into mistaken worldly ways, and one will have to undergo no more than 7 re-becomings. If we could really see that there is no difference between our own true interests and those of others, metta would come naturally. As our capacity for positive emotion grows stronger, the self-reference becomes ever more difficult to detect because it becomes harder for us to tell just where the boundaries of the self lie. The Buddhist tradition offers yet another way of understanding the situation. According to the analytical psychology of the Abhidharma, while the Brahma-viharas are positively and highly skillful mental states, they lack any element of insight. They are thus classified as samatha practices, dedicated to calming and concentrating the mind, rather than as practices devoted to the development of vipassana, or capital I, insight. As such, they are mundane, lokiya, not transcendental, lokuttara, inasmuch as they are temporary emotional states and cease to exist once the factors that have provided support for them, such as regular meditation, spiritual friendships, study, retreats, and right livelihood, are removed. This said, according to the Abhidharma, the Brahma-viharas can be transformed by the insight generated by sustained reflection,
itself, supported by the basis of samatha that they provide. They will then arise naturally from the clear knowledge that there is no real difference between self and others. But as cultivated states, they are not themselves capable of that transformation. As a result of this kind of analysis, it was said, and perhaps Buddha Ghosha bears some responsibility for this, that metta doesn't take you very far along the path to enlightenment. The traditional Theravadan view is that you cannot gain enlightenment by practicing the metta bhavana alone, because the metta bhavana is essentially a samatha practice. Indeed, it came as a surprise to me when I lived among Eastern Buddhists to find that the metta bhavana was often regarded as a simple little practice that anybody could do, 2 minutes of it at a time being considered more than enough. The Theravada's relegation of metta bhavana to the samatha side of things seems to be an example of a general methodological undervaluation of positive emotion associated with a preference for expressing spiritual perspectives in negative terms. In the Pali Canon, and in the Theravadan tradition that is based upon it, enlightenment is generally spoken of as a state in which the self has been eliminated, or to translate the term nirvana literally, snuffed out. But in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the same aim is envisaged in positive terms. Not as the elimination of the ego, but as a deeply realized attitude of even-mindedness towards all. There are other sections of the Pali Canon that make it abundantly clear that, just as there are negative emotions that bind beings to the wheel of rebirth, there are positive emotions that are not just conducive, but absolutely necessary to the attainment of insight. Insight is, after all, a realization of, among other things, a state of egolessness, and this is the aim of the metta bhavana. You succeed in the practice of the metta bhavana when in the fifth stage you can genuinely feel equal love towards all. If your care for others is made genuinely equal to your care for yourself, your whole attitude is egoless. Taking metta towards insight. Realizing the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. The traditional Theravadan attitude rests on the distinction it makes between the emotions and the intellect, with insight being seen as an essentially intellectual realization. But fully developed metta is inherently more than an emotion pure and simple, and insight is inherently more than just cognitive. If your experience of metta is straightforwardly emotional and not based on much reflection, then it is the emotional equivalent of insight, not insight per se. But even the deepest insight need not be experienced cognitively. That is, it need not take the form of a logical proposition. You simply live it, experience it, as a fully developed positivity and selflessness that is neither emotional nor cognitive. A common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in abstract, even metaphysical, terms rather than as a comprising concretely lived attitudes and behavior. But realizing the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. To contemplate the principle of egolessness as some special principle that is somehow separate from our actual behavior will leave it as far away as ever. If we find it difficult to realize the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is to try to be a little less selfish. The understanding comes after the experience, not before. When it is less than fully developed, metta may lack the clear awareness that is characteristic of insight arrived at through reflection on the Dharma. Nonetheless, it is always heading in the direction of a brighter and clearer awareness, as its nature is to grow and expand beyond the limits set by the self. In short, metta and insight are not separate aims. Indeed, metta is a necessary aspect of insight, and with reflection on the real nature of metta, insight will shine through. Having developed metta in a limited sense as an equal kindness towards others, you can go on to reflect on whether there is really any difference between yourself and others, and, if so, what that difference might be. Thus reflecting, you will begin to see that the idea that I am I and he is he is no more than a delusion, and in that way, metta begins to blend with insight. It isn't that you drop the metta in order to start developing insight. If in the course of your meditation you were to develop metta, and then were to begin vipassana-type reflection on that basis, it would represent a continuity of experience, not a shift from one kind of consciousness to another. The Mahayana expresses this poetically, saying that the cultivated emotions of the Brahma-viharas pass through the fires of shunyata, or emptiness, that is, non-self or non-duality, thus giving rise to the bodhicitta, or wisdom heart. Of course, in practice, one experience of metta is likely to flag, to be revived by again bringing to mind and heart other living beings before vipassana-type reflection is resumed. In this way, one's practice alternates between concentration and reflection, samatha and insight, perhaps for a long time, until eventually the two merge as clear insight rooted in powerful positive emotion. It is in terms of insight that the expansive aspect of metta, its tendency to break through any sense of exclusivity, is so important. Though it is easy to overlook this because metta has no conceivable end point. But to miss the link between metta and insight is to miss the point of metta entirely. For example, people sometimes talk about doing things for the sake of my spiritual development, which seems a grotesque reduction of any truly spiritual practice, especially in the case of the metta-bhavana, metta being essentially goodwill that is free from self-interest. That one should aim to develop that disinterested goodwill in one's own interest clearly undermines the whole enterprise. While the metta-bhavana begins with a cherishing of oneself, this is meant to be the springboard for the practice, not an end in itself. Of course, you do benefit yourself when you help others, even if you give a beggar some money because you think the giving will be good for you. At least you have parted with the money, and both parties are happier as a result. It is difficult to stop yourself from thinking of the ways you are going to benefit from what you do, but you just have to try to focus on your altruistic intention and keep the knowledge of what you will get out of your action in the background, as it were. If you are practicing the metta-bhavana chiefly for the sake of its beneficial effect on your own mind, that benefit will be diminished, as will any benefit to others, because the practice was vitiated from the outset by self-interest. The more heartfelt your intention to do the metta-bhavana entirely for the sake of others, the more beneficial the practice will be, both to you and to them. The idea is gently but persistently to expand the boundaries of your metta, and therewith the boundaries of your own self. When metta is experienced in this fully expansive mode and is universal in its scope, there is no experience of a self that is separate from anyone or anything else. To speak of oneself at this stage is almost a contradiction in terms. Just as a circle that has expanded to infinity is not really a circle anymore, having gone beyond any distinguishable shape, So the mind that has expanded to embrace all beings has gone beyond definition. Forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. The self is replaced by creative orientation of being, or rather, since being is not very Buddhistic expression, a creative orientation of becoming. This is the essence of the spiritual life. To bring about a state in which the whole movement and tendency of our being is expansive, spiraling creatively outwards and upwards. If, on the other hand, we remain fixed in the circularity of reactive consciousness, returning again and again to a fixed and finite idea of the self as the central point of reference, even spiritual achievements can become fetters by remaining our own property. Stream entry, after which, according to tradition, one is not reborn more than 7 times, is the point at which the balance of skillful and unskillful energies is decisively shifted towards the positive. Until that point is reached, there will always be some degree of conflict between our skillful aspirations and our unskillful resistance to change. For this reason, we will sometimes get tired of practicing the metta bhavana. But to the extent that we succeed in raising some genuine metta, it will, we shall find, generate its own energy and expansiveness and depend less on our efforts, at least until we again experience the resistance of some aspect of ourselves that is not behind our skillful intention. Indeed, with repeated application, the metta we develop will gradually integrate the energy of our resistance into the outward flow of our beneficial energies. Metta has the taste of freedom. If you are able to act out of metta, if you treat others just as you treat yourself, you are acting as if the distinction you unthinkingly create in your mind between yourself and others simply did not exist. In doing so, you free yourself from the power of the illusion of a separate self. This is insight. And though you might not experience it in a cognitive way, the fact that you have developed metta, the emotional equivalent of insight, means that you have developed insight nonetheless. It is a mistake to approach the practice of the metta bhavana as though it were an elementary exercise, a mere preparation for proper insight practices. The Karanaya Metta Sutta is dedicated to a very high ideal: the cultivation of metta as a path to insight. How far does metta get you? The concluding line of the sutta seems to suggest that the culmination of the perfection of metta is enlightenment itself. Taken literally, however, the line does not exclude further rebirth. The text says, "For him there is no rebecoming in any womb," which would seem conclusive if it were not for the fact that, according to Buddhist tradition, birth via the womb is not the only possible mode of birth. In fact, 4 modes of birth: from the womb, from the egg, from moisture, and apparitional birth are mentioned in Buddhist texts of all kinds. So for the traditional Buddhist, although this verse means that they will not be reborn in the human or animal realms, this does not rule out the other 3 kinds of rebirth. In the higher, heavenly worlds, for example, the gods are born by apparitional birth. That is, they just appear as the result of their previous karma. This is the mode of rebirth of the non-returner, or anagamin. He or she is reborn in the pure abodes and dwells there surrounded by the golden light of the Buddha's teaching until such time as supreme enlightenment finally dawns. This Theravadin doctrine has an approximate parallel in the Mahayana Buddhist teaching of the Pure Land, the main difference being that the Bodhisattva may take further rebirth out of compassion to help beings still suffering in impure realms of existence. The Bodhisattva Kshitigarbha, for instance, vows to refrain from becoming enlightened until every region of hell has been emptied of tormented beings. He consciously chooses to be reborn, even though, in a sense, it is an inevitable choice, flowing naturally from his compassion. Thus, like the non-returner, the Bodhisattva does not undergo the involuntary rebirth that conditioned beings must endure in consequence of their actions in previous lives. Whether or not we are prepared to take this distinction between kinds of rebirth as applicable to the text we are studying depends to some extent on how we take the text itself. We can be fairly sure that earlier on in the transmission of the Buddha's teaching, certain expressions will have had a metaphorical rather than a literal significance. Then, as the Abhidharma tradition developed through the centuries, particular terms did come to acquire a more precise meaning. The heaven realms and the different kinds of rebirth, like the dhyanas and the 51 mental events, came to be mapped out in scrupulous detail. It may be that this reference to the end of further rebirth from a womb was originally meant to be understood in a general, literary sense, rather than in a technical one. If we wish, we can certainly take this last line as meaning that one does not take rebirth in any form ever again, and that one is fully enlightened. It is hard to be certain either way. What we can be sure of is that it is at least expresses complete confidence in the connection between the cultivation of metta and highly skillful states of mind. An inheritance of joy. The metta bhavana is not a kindergarten practice. It is good to contemplate inspiring images of the consummation of metta, as we struggle to awaken a little of it in meditation. But it may sometimes be more helpful to refer back to the starting point of this whole process of spiritual expansion. The transformation begins with trying to lead a principled and upright human life. If this preparatory achievement seems a distant goal for most people, clearly, it is there that we have to put most emphasis. We know that an intellectual understanding of selflessness is not enough. But how do we go about integrating that knowledge into a deep and mature emotional awareness? In modern life, especially in the Western world, we are not adept at dealing with strong emotion, perhaps especially strong positive emotion. It is therefore not surprising that we underestimate the power of metta, and hence the importance and spiritual status of the metta bhavana. We prefer to equate the goal with the cool appraisal of the true nature of existence, rather than with an ardent and unremitting dedication to bringing all beings into the infinite light and limitless bliss of nirvana. Metta requires strong, positive energy. If your positive emotion does not last long in the bright glare of daily life, if you are restless or irritable and unable to be friendly after you have risen from your meditation seat, you will clearly need to go back to the basics of the practice. Before you start meditating, it makes sense to take a good look at how you behave in daily life. I sometimes think that people are not nearly kind enough to one another, either in their actions or in their general attitude. Any unkindness or quarrelling reveals a basic lack of metta, and unless you are willing to cultivate metta in your everyday dealings with people, there is little point in trying to cultivate it on the meditation cushion. Allowing ourselves to descend into acrimony and rancor displays a fundamental lack of faith in metta as a path of regular practice. It is as though we leave it in the shrine room and we walk away without it, even though we may have experienced it quite genuinely while there. If that happens, our metta evidently doesn't have enough strength for it to be carried over into our daily interactions with people. Metta is a high ideal, so high that it includes being ready to sacrifice life and limb for others, and it is very difficult to achieve in its fullness. We must therefore be prepared to appreciate a more limited achievement of metta as entirely genuine as far as it goes. On the other hand, even our embryonic metta should not be too delicate. It should be able to survive transplantation, to bloom at least for a few hours in the cold and busy world outside the meditation room. In meditation, you may sometimes feel that you are radiating metta from a safe and rather aloof distance. In that case, you should try introducing a greater sense of imaginative identification with others, as is customary in the Karuna Bhavana, for example, in which you aim to feel with others, putting yourself in their shoes. That warmth and empathy should be carried over into your actual relations with people. It might be worth asking yourself whether there is enough warmth in your various relationships, especially with those who also practice the Metta Bhavana. The Buddhist path is one of regular steps. The foundation of our practice has to be securely established in mindfulness and metta before we can move on to anything else. For most people, as I hope I have shown, the Metta Bhavana asks more than enough of their spiritual aspirations, and it hardly needs to be supplemented by anything except the practice of mindfulness. If we are dissatisfied with the Metta Bhavana, to ask for higher and more advanced practices is self-defeating. Naturally, we would like something different for the sheer novelty of it, and we may even persuade ourselves that we are ready for more advanced training. Of course, we are in a hurry to move on to the next stage. But all this grasping after the next attainment, the next spiritual goodie, is little more than craving and conceit. If we are dissatisfied with the Metta Bhavana, or if we are not getting on with it very well, it isn't because we have outgrown it, but rather the opposite. It probably means that we have not prepared for the practice adequately, or that we need to be more imaginative, perhaps more intuitive or devotional in our practice. It may just mean that we need to do it for longer periods or more often. The Metta Bhavana is not a kindergarten practice. If we follow the path of regular steps, as Buddhists in traditional pre-modern cultures have done for many hundreds of years, we shall begin by cultivating a healthy, happy human existence. And we start to practice metta from that foundation. These days, it is much more likely that we will be on the path of irregular steps. Only once we have learned to meditate do we think of attending to the ethical foundations necessary for successful meditation. Quite soon, we are likely to find our meditation has ground to a halt, and that we have to start cultivating the essential human qualities of uprightness, amenability, contentment, simplicity, and so on, in a more purposeful way before we can make further progress. This happens again and again. You run out of steam and have to retrace your steps to consolidate the ethical basis of your practice. It is difficult to tell which qualities are missing from that basis until you try to build on it and find that it lacks the strength to support you. This is how the path of irregular steps rather haphazardly winds its way. It is fundamental to Buddhist practice that if you prepare yourself thoroughly, you are already practicing. If you have all those positive human qualities, if you are capable, straight, and so on, the chances are that your emotional attitude towards others will already be so healthy and positive as to be akin to metta. For most people, the task in hand is not chasing after some lofty idea of insight, but establishing the basis of positive emotion. Without developing love, compassion, faith, joy, delight, rapture, we won't get very far. There has to be a firm, quiet ground of positive emotion to our life all the time. This is well within our reach. It is the normal human state. There is nothing extraordinary, nothing even particularly spiritual about it. We just happen to have sunk below that level, at least for the time being. Thus, the way of metta is not only a path of ever-increasing positive emotion leading to enlightenment. It is a guide to recovering our basic human inheritance of joy. The end.